Hello, listeners. Welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and in this episode, we venture back into the odd intersection of athletes and criminal justice. When we last discussed athletes who had been arrested, we were talking about the three Duke University lacrosse players who were accused of rape. As we know, they were ultimately exonerated before a trial began, as the Attorney General concluded that the county prosecutor was hiding exculpatory evidence in order to keep the case going. In this episode, there was a trial, and a very interesting one. It involves a lot of themes that we've discussed in previous episodes, as well as the importance of motive. The victim in this case was a man by the name of Odin Lloyd. He lived in Massachusetts and played linebacker for the semi-professional football team, the Boston Bandits. At the time of his death, Lloyd was dating a woman named Shania Jenkins. On June 17, 2013, Odin Lloyd was shot dead in North Attleboro, Massachusetts. While every homicide is a tragedy to the friends and family of the deceased, it's typically not a national news story. But this one was. Not because of Lloyd, but because of who the investigators came to believe killed him. The day after Lloyd's body was found, police conducted a search of the home of their primary suspect. Lloyd had been out with this person in the hours leading up to his death, and Shania Jenkins was the sister of his fiancée. Just over a week later, the star tight end of the New England Patriots was arrested, along with two friends, and charged with first-degree murder in a case that rocked the football world. This is the Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Aaron Hernandez. Let's briefly discuss Odin Lloyd's background. He was born in the U.S. Virgin Islands to a woman named Ursula Ward on November 14, 1985. He had a younger sister named Shaquila Tibau. Not long after his sister was born, the family moved to Antigua, which apparently is the correct pronunciation for what most people call Antigua. They lived there for a few years before finally settling in Dorchester, Massachusetts. There isn't too much information available about his childhood. We do know that he was an exceptional athlete. He focused on sports and kept out of trouble. He was described by a neighbor as the one guy on the street who would take care of himself. He would go to the local park to work out, not to hang out. In 2007, when he was 21 years old, he played with the Boston Bandits, a semi-professional football team, as a linebacker. He was good. He was really good, and there is a chance that he would have been able to make it to the NFL had he actually studied enough to go to college. But still, although he was not getting paid for it, he was able to keep playing football and make a modest living as a landscaper or performing some other odd jobs. In June 2013, Lloyd again was dating Shania Jenkins. Shania was the sister of Shayana Jenkins, the fiancé of Aaron Hernandez, which is how the two men met. Aaron Hernandez was born in Bristol, Connecticut on November 6, 1989. His father, Dennis, was Puerto Rican and his mother, Terry, was Italian. They had rocky marriages. I say marriages because they married in 1986, divorced in 1991, and remarried each other in 1996. Hernandez stated that there was constant fighting in his home as a child, and his mother threw his father out of the house on multiple occasions, but always took him back in. Hernandez had an older brother, Dennis Jonathan Jr., or DJ. Both he and his brother were very athletically gifted, and their father pushed them to excel in sports to the point of abuse. Both of the Hernandez boys had a very difficult relationship with their father. But despite this, in January 2006, when Dennis Hernandez passed away from complications to a hernia surgery, Hernandez was grief-stricken and really began to rebel. He moved out of his mother's house and in with a cousin, Tanya Singleton. To complicate matters, after Hernandez moved in with Singleton, the family discovers that Singleton's husband, Jeff Cummings, was having an affair with Terry, Hernandez's mother. Cummings and Singleton get divorced, and Cummings moves in with Aaron Hernandez's mother. Hernandez did not approve and remained with his newly single cousin, Tanya, cutting most ties with his mother at this point. In high school, Hernandez was an All-American football player. He was known for being the hardest working player on the team, at least at football. Being an athlete star, he was popular in high school and began dating his future fiance, Shyana Jenkins, in 2006. The two had met in elementary school. His football skills attracted a lot of attention. Urban Meyer, the famous coach from the University of Florida, who now coaches the Jacksonville Jaguars NFL team, flew to Connecticut, met with Hernandez's principal, and convinced him to graduate Hernandez more than a semester early so that he could come to Florida, start working out with the team, and learning the playbook. Physically, Hernandez was prepared for college football, but academically and mentally, he was not prepared for collegiate life. He was immature. He was angry at the world. He lacked discipline and responsibility anywhere but in football. He quickly descended into excessive alcohol and drug use. Later in life, Hernandez confessed in an interview that he was high on drugs literally every single time he took the field to play football. Urban Meyer was planning to cut him from the team due to his marijuana use, but relented after quarterback Tim Tebow begged him to reconsider. On the field, Hernandez excelled. He won the Jack Mackey Award as the nation's best tight end his junior year. He had good numbers, particularly in the bowl game Florida played in 2009. After his junior year, Coach Urban Meyer told him he was not welcome back on the team and encouraged him to enter the NFL draft, which he did. Hernandez was selected by the New England Patriots in the fourth round of the 2010 draft. Now, this is a podcast about the legal issues revolving around his criminal case, so we aren't going to go into his career statistics in the NFL, but suffice it to say that he was good at his position. He wasn't the best, but he could make an impact on a game in the right situations. He was certainly an NFL-quality athlete. But despite this, he was not popular with most of his teammates. He had always had off-field problems, starting from basically the moment he arrived in Florida. Problems that plagued his college career and followed him into the NFL. He had been in bar fights in Gainesville, Florida, was pulled over for driving while intoxicated, and other minor run-ins with the law while he was in college. He was not arrested for any serious felonies, and the cases were usually worked out by the football team's unofficial lawyer, Huntley Johnson. With the introduction of the money from his NFL contract, his criminal behavior escalated. He hired two of his friends to be his quote-unquote assistants. One of them, Alexander Bradley, was also his drug dealer and the guy who was in charge of calming him down when he started to lose his temper over minor slights, which happened constantly. Bradley spent nearly all of his time with Hernandez going forward. Hernandez became a suspect in a 2012 double homicide, which took place outside a nightclub in Boston. Surveillance video showed that he had been at the club with Bradley and that his silver SUV was seen in the vicinity of the crime. It's at this point that Hernandez retains the services of Jose Baez. If you've listened to past episodes, you'll recall that Baez was the attorney for Casey Anthony during her 2011 trial, so this was right after he had risen to be a national name. About 10 months after he was arrested for the Boston double murders, Bradley and Hernandez had a falling out. In February 2013, police found Bradley in a parking lot with a bullet in his head. But Bradley survived somehow, lost his right eye in the process. Bradley did not cooperate with law enforcement, deciding to seek revenge on his own. He filed a civil lawsuit for damages against Hernandez in federal court in the state of Florida, and then testified against him in the Boston murder trial. Baez successfully defended Hernandez despite Bradley's testimony, and he was acquitted of the murders, though he was convicted of possession of an illegal handgun. So that's the background for Aaron Hernandez that you need to keep in mind when you consider the Odin Lloyd murder case. Hernandez was clearly not a saint, and after he was signed to the Patriots, his criminal activities became high-profile affairs. Through his girlfriend/fiancé, Hernandez had met Odin Lloyd in Massachusetts. As we noted before, Lloyd was dating Shania Jenkins, the sister of Shyana Jenkins. They met casually, first at barbecues, in housewarming parties, that sort of stuff. But they quickly bonded over football. Odin Lloyd had a deep understanding and appreciation of the game, and Hernandez felt comfortable with him because of it. So what went wrong? How did Lloyd go from friend to murder victim? And what caused this relationship to collapse? The truth is, we may never get a comprehensive answer to this question. But I'll share with you what I found to be the two most plausible accounts. And bear in mind, these are guesses based on what I've read. You have to decide for yourself whether you think them credible. The police's theory was that Aaron Hernandez was bisexual, and Odin Lloyd knew it. Lloyd either threatened to make it public or indicated he was going to expose this fact, and Hernandez responded by killing him. There are several problems with this theory. For me, the biggest one is that it still doesn't explain the breakdown of the relationship at all. If Lloyd was going to quote-unquote out Hernandez, then it seems that the relationship had already taken a sour turn. So this may or may not be true, and it may or may not have been what led to Hernandez's decision to shoot Lloyd, but even if it is true, I don't think it actually explains why their friendship eroded. That brings me to the second theory that kept popping up, which I find to be a little more plausible, though still problematic. The second theory goes that Hernandez and Lloyd were out at a nightclub, drinking, partying. Hernandez looks up and sees that Lloyd is talking to a few guys off to the side that Hernandez had exchanged sharp words with previously, and Hernandez viewed this as a betrayal. Knowing what we know about how easily Hernandez took offense, this could have happened. And Hernandez was known for responding in ways that were wholly inappropriate for the situations presented. He overreacted to everything. So this is about as good a theory as I've come across, even if it's not great. I can't say whether it's true, but it makes some sense to me because it also explains why Lloyd likely didn't know that Hernandez had turned on him. Let's focus for a minute on what we do know about the situation. On June 17th, 2013, Lloyd was found shot to death in an industrial park about a mile away from Hernandez's house. The night before, Hernandez had texted two friends, Carlos Ortiz and Ernest Wallace, saying, quote, "You can't trust anyone anymore," end quote. And we know that Lloyd texted his sister later the night of June 16th or early in the morning of June 17th that he was with, quote, NFL, end quote, in obvious reference to Hernandez. We also know that Hernandez and Lloyd texted each other about spending time together the night of June 16th. A search warrant was executed on Hernandez's house on June 18th, 2013. In the day between the discovery of Lloyd's body and the search, Hernandez had hired a deep cleaning crew to clean his entire house. One of his cell phones had been crushed to pieces, and his security camera system had been destroyed. I don't think anyone will be surprised to hear that this raised some eyebrows with local law enforcement. On June 26, 2013, Hernandez was arrested for first-degree murder charges and a variety of weapons offenses. Over the following 2 days, Carlos Ortiz and Ernest Wallace were also arrested. The prosecutor assigned to the case was William McCauley. The judge assigned to the case was the Honorable E. Susan Garsh. And this was significant because Garsh had presided over the 2010 trial of George Duarte, accused of murdering a 15-year-old boy. During that trial, McCauley, who also prosecuted this case, repeatedly criticized Judge Garsh's rulings and attacked her lack of experience. He frequently told the media that he did not believe Judge Garsh was experienced and qualified enough to preside over the trial. He gave an interview in the media where he said, quote, "We expect and demand more from the witnesses and the judge who hear these most serious cases," end quote. He also claimed her evidentiary rulings were unfair and improper. When the Hernandez case was assigned to Judge Garsh, McCauley filed a motion asking her to recuse herself based on their previous conflicts. Judge Garsh denied the motion and informed him that she intended to keep the case. Hernandez hired the national law firm Ropes & Gray to defend him, specifically the attorney Michael Fee. He did not retain Jose Baez, despite Baez getting him acquitted during the previous shooting. Fee is now a partner at the Boston office of Connecticut-based law firm Veraldana. Prior to that, he was a partner at the huge, prestigious national firm Latham & Watkins, and before that, he was a partner at Ropes & Gray when he handled the Hernandez case. While in private practice, he's focused on government investigations, federal white-collar crime cases. He's also worked as a federal prosecutor in the public integrity section of the Department of Justice, going after public officials who engage in misconduct. He was a pretty seasoned defense lawyer. Fee filed a motion to move the trial out of Bristol County, claiming the jury was too saturated with news of the high-profile case. it should come as no surprise to fans of this show that that motion was denied. Other motions followed, though, which became very important to the direction of the case. The day after Lloyd's body was found, police came to Hernandez's home with a warrant to search his property. At the time, Hernandez had given another of his cell phones to his Ropes and Gray lawyers, and it was at their office. When the police officers asked him for his phone, he told them he didn't have it and where it was. ADA Patrick Bomberg, who was assisting McCauley with the trial, sent a trooper to the Ropes and Gray office to obtain the phone. Hernandez's lawyers complied and turned it over. The defense filed a motion seeking suppression of the cell phone data, specifically the text messages recovered from the phone, on the grounds that the prosecutors had misrepresented their authority to take the phone. The argument was that the warrant was for the home, so legally they could not demand that the law firm turn over property that was not in the home. Seems to make sense, right? Judge Garsh denied the motion and ruled that prosecutors could use the phone and introduce the texts into evidence at the trial. In a lengthy decision on the topic, Judge Garsh ruled that based on the facts and evidence surrounding how the phone changed custody, that at no point did ADA Bomberg explicitly or implicitly claim authority to send a state trooper to Hernandez's lawyers or indicate that the seizure was pursuant to the warrant. So, in plain English, what this means is Judge Garsh decided that the trooper had merely asked nicely, and Hernandez's lawyers complied completely voluntarily and not because there was a judicial warrant ordering them to. I can't say that I agree with this ruling. The idea that a defense lawyer would turn over a critical piece of evidence, which also happened to be the personal property of his client, to a state trooper just because they asked for it strains belief. Setting aside that I'm a defense lawyer, I think common sense would tell us that the phone was only turned over because, at the very least, an implicit understanding that the lawyers were under a legal obligation to do so. Such a finding would have rendered the phone precluded from the trial, but Judge Garsh disagreed, and the text messages between Hernandez and Lloyd, as well as the text between Hernandez and his co-defendants, Ortiz and Wallace, came in as evidence. But Judge Garsh did make several rulings favoring Hernandez. She ruled that the text messages Lloyd sent to other people, including his sister, would be excluded. The jury was not able to hear about other pending murder charges or the allegation that Hernandez shot Alexander Bradley in Florida. And Judge Garsh excluded a 2009 photo of Hernandez wielding a gun, saying it was too remote in time to be relevant. It also came out that in addition to his home, Hernandez had a separate secret apartment not too far away. Law enforcement searched that apartment and recovered ammunition of the same caliber used to kill Lloyd. They also recovered a pistol magazine filled with bullets in Hernandez's Hummer. All of the ammunition was suppressed. Judge Garsh did not fully explain why, and shockingly, the prosecutors did not contest the defense request to keep it out. This brings up an interesting issue with regards to suppression motions. When a criminal defendant loses a suppression motion, that evidence can be put in at the trial. If it is introduced and the defendant is convicted, he can make that ruling on suppression part of his appeal. He has the ability to claim that the decision was incorrect, and as a result, he was convicted based on an unfair trial. But let's think about what happens the other way. Let's say that the defense wins a suppression argument, and then the defendant is acquitted as a result. Double jeopardy bars the defendant from being tried again for the same crime, so the prosecutor cannot appeal the evidence ruling and seek a do-over. So does the prosecutor have any recourse if a judge botches a suppression hearing, or are they simply stuck with it? The answer is that a prosecutor has the option to directly appeal a hearing decision to the appellate division before the trial starts. It is not too common, but it does happen. It's called an interlocutory appeal, meaning the issue is appealed while the case is still pending. The prosecutor then asks the appellate court to weigh in on whether the hearing was rightly decided. And that would be the only issue the appellate court would decide. They won't look at sufficiency of the evidence, other court rulings, whether there was probable cause for the arrest, etc. In my experience, prosecutors only do this type of appeal when they are very, very confident that the law supports their position and that they will win. So they frequently do prevail. but this is more a factor of only picking cases to appeal that they're supremely confident about than it is the appellate division siding with prosecutors against criminal defendants. Despite having a good amount of evidence he wanted to introduce at the trial precluded, McCauley decided not to appeal. The trial started on January 29, 2015. Patrick Bomberg delivered the opening statement for the district attorney's office. You can actually find YouTube clips of the opening statements if you want to watch them, but they're each over an hour long, so I could just give you a brief rundown. I've talked about opening statements in past episodes, so I'm not going to go into a full explanation here, but in general, the opening statement is a roadmap of what the lawyer expects the evidence in the trial to prove. Opening statements and summations are not evidence. They are merely opportunities for lawyers to address the jury directly and talk about the evidence that is going to come in, or in the case of a closing argument, comment about what the evidence means or what it shows now that it has been introduced. In your opening statement, you cannot make arguments, as the evidence hasn't been put in yet. That's the most common objection that you will get during opening statements, that the lawyer is going into argument about the evidence rather than merely stating what he or she believes that the evidence is going to show. There's a big difference. We'll do one quick example on this and move on. A lawyer can certainly say, "Ladies and gentlemen, you will hear from Jeff Bilski, the victim in this case, that the defendant, Nathan Evans, deliberately set his chair on fire and destroyed his property. You will see an insurance claim establishing the value of the chair and hear from Officer David Hirsch that the defendant confessed to burning the chair." What you cannot say is, "Ladies and gentlemen, Nathan Evans had been plotting to burn Jeff Bilski's chair for weeks, waiting for an opportunity, and on January 15, 2008, the anger and hatred in his heart drove him to take the opportunity offered. He waited for everyone to go to sleep and burned Jeff Bilski's chair." The first statement tells the jury what the evidence will show. The second argues what the evidence means. There were things to like about Bomberg's opening statement. He clearly had a mastery of the timeline of events he and McCauley were promising to prove. He highlighted some important details, which he claimed the evidence would establish. He talked about the text messages and connected the dots to show that he intended to prove that Lloyd was with Hernandez very shortly before his death, and that Hernandez's DNA was found at the crime scene. But the prosecution opening failed in one major aspect. It never answered the question, why? Bomberg never said, "And you'll hear that the reasons Hernandez killed Lloyd were X, Y, and Z." Many legal commentators say there are three key aspects to proving a defendant's guilt: motive, means, and opportunity. Bomberg spoke about means and opportunity, but he didn't say a word about motive. Now, motive is not an element of murder. Technically, the prosecution does not need to prove any particular motive for the crime, or that a motive even existed. But in a murder case where the parties, up until very recently, were friends, you can bet the jury is going to expect to hear why the district attorney thinks that Hernandez turned on and killed Lloyd. But they didn't address it. There were also good and bad parts of Michael Fee's opening statement. Jurors typically do not like to be pandered to. Fee's statement that Hernandez, quote, "played for our hometown team, the New England Patriots," end quote, was an unwise move. Attorneys who don't have substantive arguments make appeals to tribal instincts like sports pride. It weakens the rest of what you're saying, and it sounds desperate. But Fee did pick up on the lack of motive and hammered the prosecution for it. Fee did a good job of ridiculing some of the circumstantial evidence without sounding petty. The strongest point that Fee made was repeating time and again that just because Hernandez spent time with Lloyd the night that he died does not mean that Hernandez killed him. Now, that may seem obvious, but it's a smart move to remind the jurors of that, because that's essentially your whole defense. The first witness called by the prosecution was Lorne Giroux. His entire testimony consisted of saying that he was Lloyd's boss, Lloyd didn't show up for work on Monday, June 18th, and that he was a good and reliable worker. I spent a good deal of time in the previous episode on Jeffrey Skilling discussing the strategy behind witness order. This witness was a dud, a complete throwaway, and that set the wrong tone for the prosecution right from the start. In situations where a witness does not really harm the case, the defense attorney has a critical decision to make with regards to how to handle the cross-examination. If a witness provides critical, damaging information, then you have to aggressively cross-examine and show that they're either biased, mistaken, or lying. But if the witness doesn't hurt you, a lot of times the best thing to do is nothing. Show the jury that this witness was a waste of their time and don't ask a single question. Silence can speak louder. Even if they testify to things that you know aren't true, why waste the time and energy correcting them when they don't hurt you? It's a far more powerful message to just show the jury that you've dismissed their entire testimony as completely irrelevant. And that's what Fee did with Giroux. After a relatively sluggish start, McCauley started to gain some steam. He put evidence to show that police found five 45 caliber shell casings at the crime scene. These matched shell casings investigators found in a dumpster next to an Enterprise car rental where Hernandez returned a rented Nissan Altima the afternoon after Lloyd's death. That Nissan is recorded returning to Hernandez's house in the early morning hours after Lloyd was killed. A manager at the car dealership told officers that she cleaned the shell casings from Hernandez's car after it was returned and threw them in the dumpster. Investigators also recovered a cigarette butt at the crime scene with Hernandez's DNA. Lack of motive aside, this is a pretty strong circumstantial case. Hernandez's attorneys were faced with a tough decision on what the best defense would be. We've talked in the past about common defenses, but just to quickly recap, there are two general categories of defense arguments. One, it wasn't me. This is when a defendant claims that they were either misidentified, they weren't even there, they have an alibi, whatever. The argument for the jury is, I'm not guilty because I did not do what I'm accused of. Two is, I did it, but I'm not criminally responsible because of some additional factor at play. These are what are known as affirmative defenses. They cover things like insanity, mental illness, self-defense, duress, those kind of things. So knowing that investigators have text messages showing Hernandez discussing picking up Lloyd that night, and video surveillance of them together at a nightclub, Hernandez's DNA at the crime scene, that Hernandez intentionally destroyed some electronic devices and conducted a deep clean of his home directly after the murder took place, and that he returned a rental car the day after the killing, which had shell casings matching the type used to kill Lloyd. Knowing all of that, what is the defense? Can you argue that he just wasn't there without getting laughed out of the courtroom? Can you claim with a straight face that Hernandez has no idea what you're talking about because he wasn't anywhere near the incident when it happened? Hernandez's defense team didn't think so. They conceded that Hernandez and Lloyd were together that night. They conceded that Hernandez was at the industrial park around 3:30 in the morning when Lloyd was killed. They conceded he was present at the shooting, but they claimed that the actual killing was done by Ortiz and Wallace. They further had to argue that Hernandez had no idea that they were even planning to kill him, did not participate in any way, and did not do anything which would have made him an accessory. They basically claimed that he was completely clueless, did not know why they ended up in the industrial park, was shocked when his friends killed his other friends, and then didn't know what to do, so he just went home, returned the car, cleaned the house, and didn't say a word to anyone about it. They conceded that mistakes were made, but they argued that that did not make him a killer. The defense also accused the police of conducting a lazy and sloppy investigation. They said that the police developed a theory right from the outset and never bothered to investigate anything else, working to fit the facts to their theory instead of building a theory from the facts that they uncovered. The defense strategy failed here, and Aaron Hernandez was convicted of first-degree murder on April 15, 2015, after a 9-week trial. In Massachusetts, a first-degree murder conviction carries a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Massachusetts does not have the death penalty. While his case was pending appeal, Aaron Hernandez committed suicide in prison on April 25, 2017. Massachusetts followed the legal principle of abatement ab initio, meaning that if a person dies while their criminal appeals are still pending, his lawyers can file a request to return his legal status to what it was at the very beginning of his case, which is innocent. Hernandez's request was granted, and his conviction was vacated. My own personal suspicion is that the lawyers did this so that Hernandez's family could keep his NFL contract money. It would make it easier for his estate to fight the wrongful death suit brought by Odin Lloyd's family. But on March 13, 2019, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts reinstated his conviction and completely ended the practice of abatement ab initio, saying it was outdated and never made sense to begin with. In summation, let's take a moment and discuss the two theories. First, the prosecution's narrative was sloppy. They couldn't settle on one motive, and after not discussing it at all in the opening, introduced several different ideas during the course of the trial. That's a mistake. It sends a message to the jury that you don't know why this happened. And if you can't explain why it happened, it makes it less likely that you're right when you say it definitely happened. It also hurt that all of the various motives they threw out there were fairly ridiculous. Not being able to plausibly explain to the jury why Aaron Hernandez murdered somebody he had long considered a good friend was a big problem and should have been exploited more by the defense. Now the defense case. In my mind, Hernandez lost this case when his attorneys conceded that he was present when Lloyd was shot. If I'm a juror, and I hear that, even without a lot of the other strong circumstantial evidence, I'm thinking that if he's present when this guy gets killed, it's not hard to believe that he's somehow involved. Once you put him at the scene, jurors are going to be wondering why, if he wasn't involved, was he allowed to just watch his two friends commit murder and just walk away? And if they knew Lloyd was his friend, why would his friends kill Lloyd in front of him? Neither Ortiz nor Wallace testified. If it was me, I would have claimed that Hernandez wasn't there. But Paul, you say, what about the DNA on the cigarette butt? It was found at the scene. It proves he was there. You'll lose all credibility if you claim he wasn't. To that I say, rubbish. The cigarette butt just shows that a cigarette butt was there. I argued to the jury that Hernandez and Lloyd partied together that night because they're friends and that Wallace and Ortiz were with them. I tell the jury that Hernandez was smoking cigarettes in the rental car and put a cigarette butt in a car door. After partying, Hernandez went home, left the car with Ortiz and Wallace to drive Lloyd home. They drive about a mile from Hernandez's house, and they murder Lloyd. Hernandez has no idea. That explains why the murder took place so close to Hernandez's home. When they get to the industrial park, they open the door, and the cigarette butt falls out of the car. Ortiz and Wallace were supposed to return the car to Hernandez's home after dropping Lloyd off at home, because he was supposed to return the rental car the following day, which he did, not knowing that there were shell casings in it. My client was never in the industrial park, had no involvement or idea that this was happening, had absolutely everything to lose and nothing to gain from this, and would not have gambled his entire future on the desire to kill a good friend for reasons that nobody seems able to articulate. That's how I would have argued it. And if you can poke holes in my theory, I am happy to discuss it. But that's the story of Aaron Hernandez, a promising career cut short by murder. I didn't have time to really go into the issue of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, which a growing number of people very strongly believe may have played a significant role in Hernandez's aberrant behavior. Listeners who are interested in how repeated head trauma may affect decision-making and impulse control can let me know, and if possible, I can try and work it into a future episode at some point. As always, a special thank you to Dan Townsend, my brother and audio engineer, for the music and the audio quality, and thank you to everyone who has reached out and spoken to me about the show. It really, really means the world to me. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to subscribe to the show, so you'll automatically get notified whenever a new episode is published. If you have any feedbacks or comments, you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod or look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.